Access number 29536, Mr. Bert Scriven, room 16.
Still standard. But I just carried on and on, just seeing that everything was running smoothly as I could. Oh, we did give one concert by the troops for the troops.
Tell me about that.
Well, the quartermaster wrote a sort of sketch about various local topics and some rather risque and ribald comments and so on the way. On the whole, it seemed to go down pretty well, one way and another.
Yeah,
I had a very, very small part. Most of my time I spent typing out the script for everything that was going on and trying to work out a programme. It was a sort of usual thing that is instantly forgettable. It was probably a terrible performance by everybody. I think the greatest impact was when three officers, the commanding officer, the quartermaster, don't know who the third one was, sat on a thunderbox on the stage with their trousers down and held a sort of comic discussion between themselves. That's about all I can remember, to be honest. I seem to spend more time telling locals that they couldn't have a ride in one of our lorries, no matter what they said or what they offered, come to that.
Were you aware of the black market? And that kind of thing?
Or black market in Italy always existed. We didn't deal in it, at least I didn't, actively. It was only the one occasion for the Christmas earlier that I dealt with it there, and that was with the aid of the chief of police. But no, we settled down, we lived with the, or some of the troops lived in the same house, of course they were billeted. It was quite normal to see one of our squaddies nursing the baby of the family on the doorstep and trying to scrounge rations for the people they were living with. They were the local baker. It's something like the custom used to be over here, apparently, a couple of hundred years before, where the local baker would cook their meals for them for a small fee. They'd present the baker with an uncooked meal and he'd bung it in the oven with everybody else's and he would cook it. There was meat on sale. Usually I can remember a sort of a market stall in the high street and horrible pieces of straggly, scraggy meat hanging on hooks with flies swarming all around them, which was extremely off-putting, offering that for sale. Nothing like a joint, just strips and pieces of meat. Their bread was black bread, I suppose you'd call it. Very dark, very hard. Crusty, I suppose one would say, but it wasn't. It was damned hard and horrible. Most of the men of the household, I discovered as a local custom, would eat the centre out of a slice of bread and throw the crust off to his kids or his wife to eat. olive oil, of course, was plentiful. They had a horrible habit of cooking cabbage and pouring olive oil all over it and eating it like that, something I could never get used to.
You got on well with the Italians, haven't
you? Yeah, yes, we got on very well with them. We learned a little Italian. Vino Italian, we called it. And they learned a little English, and it was strange that I found in Italy that everywhere you went, no matter how small a village, there was always someone who could speak English after a fashion. And if one had a discussion with them and asked where they learned the English, strangely enough, they all seemed to have lived at some time or other in either America or London. And in America, it was New York. If they lived in London, it was strange that they all seemed to have lived in Bethnal Green for some reason or other. No matter who you said, you know, well, where were you living? Oh, it's in Bethnal Green. If it was in America, it was in the Bronx or some such place. I never found anywhere else they seemed to live. I can't imagine that there was that size of an enclave, but still.
Now, what was happening as you move into the next year, into 1946, in fact?
Well, it's 1946, then we moved on again, and we returned, strangely enough, to Battipaglia, which was where we invaded in the first place, and just off the village of Battipaglia.
Now, when did you move there? Who moved there? All of you, didn't you?
No, the Carder again. And we took over a camp, I don't know what kind of camp you call it, just a protective one, really, just for administration purposes, of Chetniks. Now, we thought when we took it over that they were going to be prisoners of war or something similar, but they weren't. They were free to come and go as they liked. All we did was just administer to them. Ah, something I forgot, that when we were running the prisoner of war camp, I had my first and only leave to UK, which was very nice. Unfortunately, it was in October or November, and it wasn't very good weather. But that's the only time I ever left Italy, or left the forces, as it were, for any period. However, back to the Chetniks. We administered the camp.
That's what you call them, Chetniks, is it?
Chetniks, yeah. They were Yugoslavians, supporters of... can't think of the bloke's name.
Not Tito.
Tito, yeah. I think they were the supporters. I'm never sure whether they were his supporters or whether they were against him. But anyway, they'd landed up in Italy, and we were looking after him, providing them with rations, clothes, whatever. They were free to come and go as they liked. So there was nothing else much I was doing. I did journey from Battipaglia to Naples quite a lot for supplies.
Anything you remember about this period?
Yeah, I had 3 or 4 days leave in Naples, and managed to get to, an opera company there, San Carlo Opera Company, and I saw Carmen there, and also Gracie Fields came across from Capri and used the San Carlo Theatre for a performance while I was there. Unfortunately, I went with another bloke, and the only seat we could get were in a box, stage box, but right at the top of the theatre, so you had to positively lean over the edge to see who was on stage. We got a fantastic bird's eye view, and that was about all. But she had one hell of a personality. Sitting at the back of the box as we were, waiting for something to happen, she came on stage and one could feel it. It was strange. It wasn't the applause, it wasn't anything like that. It was just a feeling that she was there and she had arrived on stage. It was fantastic. She gave a very good performance too. There were opportunities to go across to Capri, but I hadn't got the time to do it. And the only other place that I missed seeing was Pompeii. Right opposite the gates of the entrance to Pompeii was a little naffy, and I stopped there regularly on my journey to and from Naples to have tea and wads. I never did once think to take the time to walk across and go in the gates of the ruins. I've regretted that ever since. I really have. The only other abiding memory is the street urchins, the kids in Naples, who were thieves to the last of them. And one could never drive a lorry through Naples without having somebody in the back of it, and back of the lorry, to prevent the kids coming over the tailboard as you drove through and throwing out half the goods you were carrying.
Anything happened while you were at Bragipelia? Sorry.
Nothing in particular, except that was where in 1946 I was demobbed, or rather sent home.
And when was that?
That was April, May. The only thing I can remember about that is that we had an assessment of our character and conduct written by the then CO. Now, most of our cadre had already been demobbed. Because of my age, I was about the youngest one there, and I had been right through my career, strangely. My demob was deferred. The oldest age plus service was combined, and so my group was very late. That's why I was so long in being demobbed. But the new CO, he thought he was tough, and he said there was never any time he was going to write a character for anybody who was exemplary. There's no such animal. Strangely enough, I did get an exemplary. I think it was probably the only one he'd ever written. I had no record of any kind.
What was the demob procedure like? You got back to, you were demobbed from Aldershot, I think.
Yes. Well, what happened was we went to a transit camp in the Naples area. Some were selected to fly home. The rest of us were selected to train. The first thing we did was get on a train and chug off. We didn't know what the route would be, but we finished up in Milan into a transit camp there. And we stayed there a few days until there was another train which took us off through the tunnel from Domodossola, where we had breakfast. Meals were provided at various stations, and Domodossola was one. Their job was to provide breakfast. Didn't matter what time the train got in, you got breakfast. And then we went on in the train through Switzerland, France, Dieppe, where we got on the New Haven ferry. We were warned again and again and again about carrying weapons with us, foreign German weapons that we'd acquired. I wasn't carrying anything and didn't intend to, but we were all really loaded. I gathered a great big expanding suitcase and my kit bag and my full marching order and so on. And anyway, we had to go through customs, of course, marched all the way around a large hall. The customs were behind a desk, horseshoe-shaped as I remember, and in between us there were red caps circulating who would pull a bloke out of line as indicated by one of the customs officers. Again, we were warned, you know, if we were carrying any weapons, for God's sake, hand them over, else. Well, strangely enough, I mean, we all walked round as if trying to make very light of our loads, as if we weren't carrying lots of cigarettes and whatever that probably we shouldn't have been carrying, or gifts or so on. However, one of the customs bloke told a red cap to pull out a bloke a couple ahead of me, and they opened his suitcase and he got a Tommy gun in it. I'd never seen anybody disappear so fast in all my life. He just went That's the only incident I remember. Then we got on a train, went through to Aldershot. At Aldershot, we were bunged into barracks, slept overnight, and then we went through the process of being equipped with civilian clothes. Now, it may have been a bit of luck, I don't know, but by the time I'd got cigarette rations and chocolate rations and all the other stuff I'd been carrying, I got nowhere to put it all. So as I went into the clothing area to choose a suit, I was beginning to drop everything. So bloke said to me, let's measure for size and so on. And just a chest measurement, that's about all you got. And racks of suits. And he asked me, he was kind enough, to ask me what sort of suit I would like. I told him it didn't really make much difference. But as a happy thought, I dropped some cigarettes out of Cartner 200 Senior Service, I remember. And I said, could you take this off me? I can't be bothered to keep on carrying all this stuff. I keep losing it. So he said, well, let's have it again. What kind of suit? And I said, well, blue one. Something it'll do for the city, single-breasted preferably, and so on. And he said, racks over there. And there were a whole series of racks of suits in various sizes and so on. And I went to have a look, and he said, no, not that one. He said, come back here. And we went through and found another rack right at the back. And he selected a suit, which was actually very good. I did discover later on that there were, in the labels inside, there were code numbers which indicated the manufacturer, I think. When I was demobbed, I found a bloke who knew the secret of the codes, and he had a look at mine, and he said, you're lucky. He said, I thought it was a good one. I said, why? He said, well, that's one of Simpson's of Piccadilly. So I said, oh, thanks very much. But having got that, and we'd been documented and signed off and so on, had to hand in...
this was when, May 46?
May. Boots and so on, I think it was. No, boots we kept. Greatcoat? Yeah, greatcoat, I think it was. We were then given our discharges, taken down to the station, told to make your way home. Oh, travel warrant, of course, which I did. First of all, I stopped off in my parents' home in London. And then I discovered a wife had already moved to London to be with a sister who'd got some empty rooms above an empty shop. And so we took a couple of the rooms, and that's where we landed up for the next 2 years.
Now, what about work? What were you going to do?
Well, I was going back. I was working for an advertising agency in Fleet Street, training as a space buyer. Media executive, I think they call them these days. And I went back to them. The job was guaranteed. Anybody who was called up was guaranteed their job again.
How did you fare? Because, I mean, you'd had a lot of experience, you'd done a responsible job in the army, and you'd just been a lad when you joined up, you know.
Yeah, that's right. I knew as little then about the civilian life as I knew as of the army life when I joined up there. It was a bit of a shock to be sitting at a desk all day instead of roving around doing the job I ought to be doing. Fortunately, they were a very liberal-minded company, and they had a policy for senior, and I was sort of an honorary senior by that time, people that if you got stuck with ideas, whatever you were doing, composing and so on, if you got stuck with ideas, they had no objection to you walking out, having a walk round, go and have a pint, and there were pubs in plenty in that area. Do what you like until you felt you might be getting somewhere with your thoughts and so on. You go back and do it. The only thing they insisted on was that if things were doing well, you were ideas were flowing, then you would stay after hours and carry on. It was a give and take idea, and I found it very useful.
So did it take you long to acclimatise as sort of civilian life?
Yes, yes it did. I never really settled. I couldn't get used to being stuck in an office at a desk. I'd been too used to being out, not necessarily in the open all the time, but free to do as I want to do my job. Nobody overseeing me most of the time. Sure, I was responsible to people, but I had a reasonably free hand to do my job as I saw fit. And that was difficult. Home life wasn't very good either. My wife didn't take to living in London very much. And she was ill quite a lot of the time. She had jaundice, among other things. And in 1948, she had to... She moved back home again. I went to stay with my sister, who was living in Sanderstead, outside Croydon, and still working and so on. And eventually, the separated life became too much. And I threw in my job in the advertising agency and moved down to Ashford.
What was your career? I mean, we don't follow you much further than this. What was your adventure career? It was in work study, wasn't it?
No. I did all sorts of things.
Oh, right.
The first thing that happened was I had to report there was a control of engagement order out in 1948. Everybody who was unemployed had to report to what we then called a labour exchange. And if you hadn't a degree, if you weren't a member of a professional class and so on, then you became unskilled labour and you were directed to a job. First job I had was selling advertising space in free newspapers, library book covers and that sort of stuff. I was not good at it. I'm not a salesman, I'm a buyer. And I wouldn't have bought the stuff I was trying to sell for a pension. It would have been more than my job was worth at all. So I didn't take to it. It only lasted about 3 weeks. And it was all an expenses and commission job, no salary. So I reported back again, and they looked up my army record, well, which I gave to them, of course, and they saw that I was a technical storeman in the army. So they put me in the stores department of the railway works. And so I became what was to them a storeman. In fact, you were a labourer in the stores department. But I didn't mind that. Just plain manual labour. I didn't have to think. All I had to do was, as I was told, you know, unload that railway wagon, go and get so-and-so, or orders that were given to us for goods, just get them ready and do what was necessary. total freedom to me. I enjoyed the manual work, and later on I was then in the what they called downsidings. It was an offshoot of the stores department by the railway station, and we administered mainly to permanent way staff. And then I was moved to the railway works itself. This time I was in a store and helping to run it. I was a junior in the stores and so on. And gradually, over the next 10 years, I progressed up the ladder until I became a stores issuer, as they called it, class 2, which meant I had my own store, various ones throughout the whole works, from Bright Steel to Spring Steel to Gases. Practically anything they did, general stores and so on. I went in every store there was in the factory.
That's sort of about as far as we go with
this. Yeah.
That was where you worked with it. Now, how do you think the war had affected you mentally and physically, good and bad?
Physically, I was very fit. Mentally, I don't know. I was restless for some time. That's a certainty. I could not settle. I think the best thing that happened to me was when I started doing the manual work and so on, and then settled down to gradually going into my own type of work, or nearer my own type, and settling down. Housing, of course, was a great problem. Didn't get housed at all until 1953, so I was living with my wife's parents.
Did you join any regimental association or any old comrades association?
No, I did not.
Then why not? Because that's quite unusual.
Well, the way I thought of it is that I was a civilian in uniform. I would always be a civilian. I wasn't interested in the military life. I just wanted to live my life, the life of the pair of us, wife and myself, you know. I didn't want to go back into that. The only thing that I can remember that may have shown my mental attitude was that there was a general election just after the war finished, and I voted against the establishment. In other words, I voted Labour, which resulted in the landslide, because I was fed up with privilege. Why should an officer be able to wear brown shoes and drink spirits and wine, whereas other ranks had to wear black boots, was not allowed to wear a tie, and so it went on. Officers had clubs and stayed in hotels. Other ranks put up with whatever they were shoved in, and so on. A sort of half-rebellious, half-crusading, I suppose, frame of mind. And that stayed with me for a long, long time. I have never become one of the establishment, as it were. Even in later life, when I became work-study, which is neutral. You're between management and shop floor, whatever shop floor, staff and so on.
And you became work-studies, what, in the railways?
No. I'd moved on two or three times from there. I was working for a plastics company, Welvin Plastics. And I'd done various jobs there, progress chasing, sales and such. And eventually they decided to put work study in and ask for people who'd like to train. So I volunteered for that, and I was one of those selected after implant training, lasting about 6 months, to be one of the work study engineers. And from there on, that was 1970-something. From there on, I stayed with work study till I was made redundant in 1981, part of Maggie Thatcher's revolution. And then I had a year unemployed because there weren't any jobs. And then I did a temporary job still in work study for a firm of reproduction furniture. And that's where I stayed until I retired.
Thank you very much.